Okay, so we're going to talk about World War II in Kodiak when you were here. My question is, when did you arrive in Kodiak?
We arrived June 1941.
And you arrived with
my mother and dad, two older sisters, one older brother, and my youngest brother, who was 3 at the time. And we arrived on the Denali, which was Alaska steamship. At that time, there wasn't even a runway, and planes weren't flying in Alaska too much, except military-wise. And so it was the only way to get here, was to get on a boat, and we came from Ketchikan. We lived there 2 years. We came to Alaska in 1939.
So. Were you surprised to come to Kodiak, or was it expected during the times, or?
Well, my dad, Alfred Owen, we lived on Lake Washington at the time. No, yeah, Lake Washington in Kennedale. And he had a shingle mill. And I had 4 older brothers and an older sister, 2 older sisters, and my youngest brother and myself. And it was right at the end of the Depression. It was in 1939. And there wasn't a whole lot of work previous to that, before the Depression hit. He and his dad had a lumber yard in Seattle, and they were building houses and carrying the loans on them. So when that hit, people weren't able to pay, and they lost their lumber yard. And so then my dad went into doing whatever was available. He had graduated from the University of Washington, and there just wasn't any work. I remember him telling one time that he picked ferns for $1 a day.
Wow.
You know, for the forest. And then they did some gibble logging, and so they moved around a great deal trying to find work. It was really tough times. And so then when, I don't know how long we were, I think about 2 years that we lived in Kennedale. And so then he decided to tear the mill down and take it to Alaska. And evidently with the Forest Service permission, he was able to build it in Mud Bay and build a house. And the older, he put it on a barge along with some banny roosters.
What are banny
hens and banny, and a banny rooster.
Oh.
With a little, just a small kind of a chicken. And so then they came north, and we stayed with his dad and mother. And we came up on an old sailing, freighter called the Tongass, and had about 12 staterooms in it. And it now can be seen in Sausalito as
San Francisco?
It's in repair, but it's been in the old wooden boat museum. So, but we had quite a time. We had a good time coming up, and Mom and Dee Dee and I and Fred came up after the house was built and the mill. And so when we arrived there in Ketchikan, we lived 10 miles out of town, and the only other people out there was a few old summer homes. So my sister was in kindergarten at the time. And let's see, what was, there were 2 thoughts that was coming across there. Dee Dee was in kindergarten, and so I, of course, was only 4, so it was just my brother and I. But anyway, it didn't turn out to be such a good venture because nobody wanted to buy shingles.
In Ketchikan?
Right. Or there just wasn't a market for them because I guess we were subsidizing the Canadian, at that time, industry. And so anyway, so they went to work for another mill. And then my dad procured a job here in Kodiak, but the transportation wasn't paid because you lived in Alaska. So he and Mom went to work in the cannery downtown, and my brother, who was 13 at the time, Bud, took care of us. And he read, that's the 3 younger ones. The other ones were working in different outfits there. So anyway, they got enough money together to be able to afford the tickets on Denali to get here. So when we got here, we were supposed to have a house, and at that time, they were building the base out here because mm-hmm. they were realized that there was a war pending, good possibility of a war pending with Japan, and they needed to be putting in some defense. So they were furiously building out here. Norman Sutloff was one of the first carpenters out there in Australia. And there's a few others in town that are still around. They can really tell you, they're the ones, that's what I kept trying to tell Paul, is that you should interview, you know, one of those individuals, because they can really tell you. And another one is Jim Gavgarud.
Okay.
Mary and he were, in fact, Mary and my brother Bud went to high school together. She was Pam Aroff. And my dad went to work for the employment office here as, I guess they, whatever. What would you call it, the one that heads up the employment office? But there wasn't any housing. It was just this mass of people. And I can remember when we pulled in and on the boat, and my brother said his first recollections of Kodiak is I was bawling because I thought we were going to go back to the big city. I had been living out in the boondocks for 2 years, and Kodiak was not my idea even at 6 years old when a place where I wanted to get off.
So, keep going.
Yeah, right. It was, I can still remember that. So my mom and dad took us down to the Island Fountain, which, well, I'll get the picture.
There's okay.
Well, unless it's put it somewhere else. It's a rollout of what Kodiak looked like.
Oh, really?
And I was looking at it. I'm trying to find the rollout. Anyway, the Island Fountain would have been right straight down about where Center Street is, right on that corner. Only the street was crooked and went down that way. But it was right about where the subway is. So we went in and got a big ice cream cone.
The Island Fountain, okay.
It was the Island Fountain. And we didn't have any place to go. There wasn't any housing, even though we were supposed to have housing, and there were just thousands of people. There were 15,000 civilians that they had brought up to build the base.
Wow.
And there was something like 35,000 military. They built all of the base in 3 years. They started the survey in 1939. And of course, it had been a bunch of homesteads out there, which they just procured. I don't know that the people ever received any monetary value for their homesteads. And there was a sheep farm, I believe, out in Niners Peninsula, as I recall. You know, I mean, that's, you'd have to look more into the history of it so mm-hmm. other people could tell you that. I'm just.
Right.
And they had to build the road out there. Of course, the road had been built by the time we had gotten here. And then my dad took a job as chief clerk out on the base. And I don't know what that entailed, but it entailed working with a lot of different people. And it seems, okay, so they finally, the man who he was going to work for said, well, I know of a house down here in Tagora that I'm looking after, and the lady's out fishing. She's out gillnet, and she had a set net site over by Usinkia or someplace. So we moved into this little house for about 3 weeks, and I recall a lot of little mice running around. Before, we had our sleeping bags. Mom always made sure that we all had our own bed, so we had our sleeping bags with us. And evidently, she must have been a lady that provided some services, because in the middle of the night, guys were knocking at the window. Nina, are you there?
You know, I heard, too, that there was a lot of that at that time also here, which kind of surprised me.
Yeah. So, well, if you, now I don't want that, this part quoted.
I know, that's fine.
But if you were, you know, that the native tradition, yeah, that's the kind of information you want. But that was my first impression, so yeah, as I recall it.
Molly?
Yeah. Getting my first ice cream going, Kodiak. And, well, you know, here we were. We didn't have any place to go. You know, no house, no nothing. And the cabin we moved into probably wasn't any bigger than this whole thing. It had a little tiny bedroom.
And there were, you know, five of us. I'm not sure where Bud slept.
I don't even remember. I guess maybe we were all on the, we had our sleeping bag, we were all on the floor, and the mice were running over the top, and Mom gave them pepper, and she always believed in sprinkling red pepper around, then it'd be sneezing.
But anyway, that's
the... Whose house was it?
Irene's house? Irene Nineveh. Something like that. That was her name.
And there's this guy,
that
he said,
Irene! Irene! Daddy popped up, Irene doesn't work here anymore!
So, did your father actually help build part of the roads, or?
No, he was just involved in the building of the base, and I don't know, first, you know, with the employment office,
mm-hmm.
and then with the job he had out there. But then we finally found George Magnuson. Mom was walking downtown one day, and she heard one woman telling another woman that she was leaving Kodiak. And Mom went up and said, "Pardon me, where are you living?" And she said, "Well, I'm living in this little house over there." And Mom, which was right behind the firehouse at the time. And so Mom marched over there, got a hold of George, and we had a house. Now, it was only one bedroom. There was a living room and a kitchen and a calidor. And so we had a place for a little while, and it had running water and electric lights, because it was on the Erskine, there was Erskine's and Kraft, and they had most of the property in town, and the Russian church had property, and the rest of it taken up by the military. So it was pretty hard to even get a toehold anywhere. And so anyway, we moved into that, and then later on they found a house over on the other side of the hill. That used to be a hill right there where all those buildings are. There was a hill there.
Oh, really?
And there was the, called the Pink House. Well, if you ever read A Roman Holiday, it was supposed to be a haunted house.
Oh, okay.
And it was built during the Russian days, and it had been used as there had been a spill in there, and there was a living room, a bedroom, a kitchen, and a little shed-like affair built onto it and had a bathroom. And the shed area is where they had the spill. So we stayed there. Anyway, some of the information about, as I remember, there was a lot of air raids. We'd see the boats running back and forth in the channel. They had to plow out that channel. They dredged out that whole area. And one time, I believe it was I don't know whether it was a destroyer, but I thought it was an airplane. Not an airplane carrier. It must have been a destroyer. But it just filled the whole channel going through.
Wow.
And, they had it all mined out there, you know, for submarines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they had a net with all these mines, and they had minesweepers out there. And every Sunday they would, right in the town square down there, about where the Terrier and King is located, there on the upper part there was right about in that area was a bank and what they called the Kodiak Hotel. It was the only hotel in town. And right in that little area, they would demonstrate how to put out a firebomb. And what to do if your kids were alone, you know, get under the table, do this or do that. And then when they'd have the air raids, because the Japanese were only about 60 miles away at different times, that was the fog that protected us.
Right. I had read that, too. You also had a lot of blackouts?
Oh, yeah, we always
all
had
the time?
All the time. Yeah, you had to have the windows all blacked out every night.
Hmm.
Quite dark. Hmm. And then when we'd go down, like I say, there was just, the women all had to get their shopping done early in the morning before, you know, the military came to town because you just couldn't get across the street.
So many people?
There's just so many people. And then you see, of course, where the boat harbor is and all that was beaches. And young sailors would be down there gambling and fighting and what have you. And we always
wanted to get down there and go see if there's any money on the beach, but Mom wouldn't let us go down there. There's always the rest of the kids, so I don't recall ever finding any.
But it was, even though we had all those people here, they just had one sheriff.
Wow.
And George Magleton was the fire chief, and he was volunteer. It was all volunteer fire department. And I don't and they just had, I don't know how many cells they had in the jail, probably one. I don't know. But they never had any really serious problems. The military, of course, they always had the MPs.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd come down, they'd get these kids, and they'd whack them over the head with their billy clubs and toss them into what they call the drunk tank. On back to the base.
But there was a time I read when they'd evacuated a lot of the women and children. I don't know if it was it here, too,
mm-hmm.
that they did that?
They did. Mom wouldn't go. She said, this is my home. I don't have any home to go back to. This is my home, and she wouldn't leave. But most of the wives, that's how we happened to get the house, because they were taking all the men who had families here that were employed building the base. They evacuated them all to Seattle. Because we were, you know, I mean, Japan was trying to take over, because they could take over their get Kodiak.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the base, the airstrip was the first one built. But we really didn't have good air coverage at that time, as I understand it. We had a lot of ground forces. And, you know, like you go, have you ever gone over to Long Island?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And all that fortification and gun emplacement. And on top of the mountain, you see gun emplacement. And I remember when they started going up there and building that up there, and that was interesting a few years later after they had left to go up there. And at that time, the gun emplacements were still there, and all the underground housing was still there. It was real interesting, you know, to go down into all this housing. But they just left everything. They took everything, anything to move, they took.
Right, right.
But the structures and the guard posts and the outlook areas were all...
But a lot of people you knew left. I mean, as far as the women and children, a lot of
but
people...
But we never really got to know all of them. They just weren't here.
Right.
I remember we would have been a part of those going, and my mother refused to leave. Just like when they evacuated her over here, and Brandon brought her up here, and next thing you knew, she was going back home.
Oh, just recently with the mudslide, right?
The police had to haul her out again. And then Brandon got called in the middle of the night to come and get her. She's 91.
Oh, okay.
No one's going to put her out of her home when she hadn't changed any. And everybody out was to have a place to go to out on Mission Road. The few houses that were out there, people were designated. Mom says, we're not going out on that road. She said, we'd be prime targets. Everybody and their brother's out on that road.
Good.
Oh, probably Rob Castle, he called. He's in the flying today.
Cool. Hey, Rob.
You know,
okay.
Did you ever have any actual incidents with the Japanese here?
They never got this far. They made a number of attempts.
You should be able to.
I know when we were out on Marmot Island.
Stay there. Yeah. Right all the way
to the ground. They were probably close there, and Mom always was figuring out where we'd go out there, or they wouldn't find us.
Mm-hmm.
But it was an imminent thing at all times. They knew this area like the back of their hand.
I mean,
when you consider they were up as far as, Dutch Harbor, but
yeah.
I was
right.
Yeah.
And I remember when that incident happened.
As well, yeah.
Yeah.
My dad talking about it.
Did that affect you guys a lot? I mean, imagine it would, because it's like Dutch Harbor and then Adak and Kiska and Attu, I think, also.
Yeah, and Atka.
Okay.
A lot of those people were hauled, you know, Japan, and were in prison camps, the Navy people. And, but anyway, they didn't want any of that information to get out to over 48. They never knew about it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because they're afraid that people would panic if any of the Japanese were that close. And one of the biggest battles was fought out there. In fact, the men were, if you have a chance, you ought to read The Thousand Mile War.
No, but that's a book that I was, as a matter of fact, going to read. I heard it's a really excellent book.
And it tells about how the soldiers, they thought they were going to Africa. They didn't even have the clothes. They didn't even let them have the clothes for coming up here. And half of them died from exposure.
Because they didn't want them to know where they were going?
Yeah. And it was a Russian priest that was the spy. It did on Alaska. Mrs. Shafnikov, the one I took basket weaving from. She was from Apta originally, but she was there, and she was one of the lay readers. And they always used to clean the church and look after everything, and the priest wouldn't allow them in the back. And on his table, he had this wicker basket, and that's where the radio was in that basket.
Oh, wow.
And he was not to be found. He was able to get off the island, but he had evidently been raised in Japan as with missionary parents. And so he was the one that gave the signal when to attack.
That's interesting. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Huh. I imagine Kodiak changed a great deal from... Did you come here and then you left and then you came back, or...?
We went... Okay. My dad did many things, and we had moved next... When we moved into the pink house, there was a lady next door called Mrs. Carr, and she was quite an elderly lady. And this elderly gentleman used to come down and visit her. Her and her husband, and he had a mail route up in the interior from Rampart to Ruby or something like that. And maybe, I don't know if it went on up to Nome. They had a mail route. I was trying to think whether, I don't think it was by dog team. It may have been. But I was thinking it was by mule, but I'm not positive on that point. And his name was Bob Chamberlain, and he had come to Alaska in 1898 with the gold rush to Nome. And so my dad got acquainted with him, and he would come over and he'd tell my dad and mom stories about the gold rush thing. He had one story after another. And if you've ever seen Paint Your Wagon, someday, if you ever have a chance, watch that movie, because that's as close as to what I suspect the real gold rushers were like. Because old Bob used to tell us these stories before we'd go to bed at night. And the humor, it was always partner. My partner, it always started out with my partner and I. And then he would tell the story about, and then the planks they would pull on each other, you know, to bring some life into a very harsh situation. And so anyway, my dad got acquainted with him. And he would tell me these stories. Finally, he said, well, you know, I have this island out here. I have a lease on this island, Marmot Island, with fox lease on it. And I've taken these fox out there, reds and silvers, and raised them and turned them loose. And then he had some cabins around the island, and his partner had passed on. And he taught my dad into going out there. Now, this was during the war years. I think it was about 1942. And we were going to go out there for 3 months. Now, my brother was going to high school here. He and Dr. Bob and Billy Taylor, who became a judge and a Supreme Court judge in Alaska, one of the first ones. They were all, they call them the three Bs, Bud, Bob, and Bill. But they all went to high school here. And so he was left in town, and he stayed in the house that Katie Rogers has, which was one of her former husband, Chris Magelson. So my brother had rented a room there and stayed there, so he was the only one in town. So the next thing, as a little kid, I was in the second grade at the time, and they were going to take us to, let's see. Okay, it was in October, and we were going to be gone for 3 months, so we took all of our supplies with us. And there was this little boat. It was probably, I don't know if it was even 32 foot, somewhere in that vicinity. That we were going out in. I took one look at that, and it was probably a day about like this. The tide was way out, and there was no way I was going to get on that. My dad just grabbed a hold of me, and down the ladder we went. And fortunately, it smelled very gassy, and the guy said, asked Mom if she wanted to light the stove, and she said, no. She said, we'll be all right. I like it cool. It was a good thing he didn't, because one tank of gasoline had leaked into the bilge.
Oh, no.
It would have blown sky high. So anyway, as we went out the channel, well, they had to open up the channel because it was all mines out there. So they evidently could open this up, the minesweeper, to let us out. And the guy said, well, if I go this route around through Yuzinki Narrows, around past the Three Sisters, I think I can avoid most of the mines, and we have a flat bottom boat, so we should clear them. So the way we went. So we got out there, it took about 5.5 hours when we got over there. And they didn't have outboards in our stage, you rode. So you get in, and on Marmot Island, there isn't any harbor. It's all just really exposed, and the tide rips that come through a fog bank on Marmot Island are very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's always a surf. So the thing you have to do is when you arrive at the beach, you've got to jump out if there's any amount of surf and grab the boat and bring it out. Otherwise, you can get rolled over. And most of them had dories in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's how we arrived there, and we did arrive. And there was a three-bedroom house, very small. I remember going back 2 years later, and it was quite small. And there was a little living room and a little kitchen, and then you had your pantry and your shed. And old Bob had his bed in the living room, and there was the one room that us three kids were in, Mom and Dad had one of them, and this was a store room for mm-hmm. all the produce. And then there was a cellar underneath. And so anyway, we spent the winter out there. Well, they were supposed to pick Bob Von Scheele had the mail out around the island, and he had, you know, the mail boat, and he was to pick us up in 3 months. The thing is that he had hit a rock and had sunk. But he survived.
Right.
And then later on he got a boat, and it was cut in half. I thought it was Coast Guard, it may have been a Navy. Anyway, it went right through it.
Mm.
And about in Whale Pass area. Maybe the sun was showing wrong or something.
Right.
They didn't see him. And a woman and her child lost their life on it because that part of the boat sunk, and Bob was able, and who was with him? Somebody was telling me about the experience not so long ago. He was one that was with him. Anyway, it sunk. Oh, I know who it is. Yeah, the guy that has coffee out. But anyway, so that's why, because we didn't know. We didn't have any radio or any communication. The only thing we had was a shortwave radio, and we used to listen to Tokyo Rose every night. And so we knew what was going on war-wise, because she always knew before anybody else did what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And when the atomic bombs were dropped and all that, we listened to Tokyo Rose every night, so we knew what was going on. So 5 months later, my brother was able to get the Coast Guard to come out and get us. And they had an old boat that they had secured, and it was an old herring boat. And it was a northeasterner was building up that day, and we shouldn't even have been going anywhere. And we were all sleeping on it. About 10 o'clock in the morning, somebody was knocking at the door. Well, Billy Noem, who was a native from here, was one of the crewmen aboard the boat. And he had been out there with old Bob several summers because evidently he was having problems, so he had taken him out there. And so he knew the place. And they had to row in. Well, so we had to get packed right away and get into the skiff. And about that time, you know, the rollers were really building up, and so the boat's anchored out quite a ways, so it won't end up on the reef. And so when the roller said, "Now, when it rolls over, grab a hand." And so the dog put up her paws. We had a Riverdale dog with us. And so that's how we got aboard the boat. And then they had to row back in, get Daddy and Bob. You couldn't even see them in between, you know.
Wow.
And so that was a very, very rough trip. And Stan Lee was in. And that's the crew's infected, and they're all sicker than a dog. And we all, I can remember sitting at the table there, and the cook had a roast on, and my brother got sick. Well, that's all it takes to get me sick. So all three of us were back in the cabin with Mom, and Daddy and old Bob were standing outside, and the waves were coming over, you know, the top and drenching them. And they realized that was so rough, the reason the roast turned over in the oven. But anyway, so we finally made it back. We ended up in Danger Bay because he was saying, well, if we don't have an engine problem before we get beyond these cliffs here, well, we'll be okay.
Mm-hmm.
We made it beyond and went into Danger Bay because they did have engine problems. You always had engine problems, I think, like on both. And anyhow, so we made it back from that. And then we ran on up to Fairbanks. My dad got a job with the Wartime Commission up there. And we went up there and they were just building the bases up there in Fairbanks.
Oh, okay.
And we stayed on this homestead, which was about a mile from town. And we stayed there for only 1 year, it was, because my dad didn't like 50 below weather. And I can remember people always say, well, you always walk so fast. Well, I had to walk to keep up with my dad in the morning because you didn't have head bolt heaters or garages to keep your cars in. So you walked. And you better walk fast. Because you could freeze to death before you got there.
Well, that's crazy.
Yeah. But anyway, so we stayed there and then we came back to Kodiak.
Oh, okay.
So we were in Kodiak when the war ended.
Was it a big celebration reaction, David, it ended? Or did you hear about it? When did you hear about it?
I was in school.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking, on that note, when we were up in Fairbanks, the Russian flyers were coming over. We were giving them airplanes. And their families lived there in Fairbanks. And Mom got acquainted with them. She would have tea with them. That Mom can communicate regardless of what the language is. But she tried to make them feel at home. But I remember, you know, the Russian pilots ferrying these planes to Russia.
Oh,
my God. Good old Americans, you know, we always give our enemies everything to shoot back at. Which we, you know, Japan, we were selling them all of our scrap metal and everything, and they were making it into hardware.
Right.
Anyway, that's about all that.
What grade did your mom and war ended?
I can just say I was in the second grade, I think, when it broke up. I must have been about the fourth grade.
But y'all continued to live here?
We lived here until 1948. My dad had gotten into the fisheries with, he had been fishing off and on, but he bought a boat called the Marmot. Well, we named it the Marmot, because Marmot Island, after Marmot Island. And they fished together that, Tom had a habit of drinking at the profit, so.
Oh.
My dad got a little house up on the hill. You just couldn't get anything to live in.
Uh-huh.
You were lucky to find any tar paper shack. If you had two rooms, that was really something. So always finding accommodation was a problem in Kodiak. And we moved up there on the hill, and in the meantime, Katie Rogers wanted to sell her fishing site out in Janet Bay, and she had there was a house, a saltery, another little two-room house out there in Mush Bay, which is still there, the main house.
Mm-hmm.
And looks a little different now because Jeannie had remodeled it. But and a little 27-foot open purse seiner. It just had a little cabin on the front, and so it wasn't decked over. Open skiff, sort of like a great big skiff. So, and then the Gilness site that we still fish today.
Oh, really? Okay.
We're the oldest residents out there in the day.
Wow.
And my sister's just out there. Mm-hmm. And she could probably tell you more. She just got back, and you might, you know. She would definitely know a little more because of having been, you know, older than
you
I.
You could look right over in that house.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what you were saying earlier.
And so, you know, that's my recollection of the war years. It really doesn't tell you a lot in order to really get some of the, you know, real life stories about it, you'd have to talk to them like Norm Fell, of course, or my dad and he saw his name.
How about
Katie Rogers would be ideal.
Really? Okay.
You haven't been dirty with anyone for about the time. Another one is Claire Helgerson. I imagine she's been in the evening time. But Kate,
sure.
You know, where she lives. So she lives out over there in Las Vegas. So
got everything, I think, lined out.
After the war ended, how long did the military, all the military stay here? Did they pull out right away?
No, they were here for quite some time. I'm not sure exactly when Fort Greely moved out. It was Fort Greely that moved out. And of course, they located up at Big D.
Oh, okay. Well, actually, it's really interesting, the little details that you... The little details that you remember in your perspective as a child. Actually, that's really neat. I think it is anyway. But were you here during the tsunami also, or you were not here?
We were in Anchorage.
You were in Anchorage? Oh, you were actually in Anchorage in that time.
Yeah.
And what was that like?
That wasn't fun.
I was that one too, but...
Well, that was... Have you ever seen any pictures on that?
Yeah, I have.
Of the Anchorage
one? In the Anchorage Museum.
Yeah,
that's just crazy.
Yeah, because I have some pictures. My husband worked for the highway department at the time. I had worked for them and had worked for the telephone company over there. And, I see James was just 6 months old. That was the one that was just going out. And we were sitting there having dinner, and I had a friend come over who had a little girl that was about the same age. And she was having dinner with us, and... it started to shake, and we always had a lot of earthquakes. And an earthquake, and it didn't stop. So we jumped up. Greeting. Sue Bowie.
Close enough, never can say. Hi, nice to meet you.
Rollin. She was like trying to find out what I could remember of the warriors, and all I could tell her is what I remember as a child.
The warriors.
But Peggy thought it would be an ideal one.
Okay.
They're just really neat people. How we got associated with them is that my dad and after the war, this is the part that I was going to get to, after the war. Okay, Ben Kraft didn't want to get into the lumber business. He was selling some, but he just didn't, that was one part of it he wasn't interested in. And Fred Solberg had a little sawmill out here at Island Lake. So my dad decided he'd take out a homestead out there. He thought that my brothers would like to, they came back, have something to go to. And it went clear to the ram site and back. And then first I'm getting ahead of myself. So we were living up on the hill in this little cabin, and next door across the dam was Norm Sutloff. And as kids, first my brother went over and got acquainted with him, and then my sister and I, and we'd go over, how kids are. And he was fixing up the place for Peggy. He's putting in new cabinets and everything, and we'd ask him a zillion questions. Well, she was outside on vacation. She'd come up, I think, 1939 to marry him.
Well,
and they didn't have any children at the time. She'd gone out to visit. Well, when you went out to visit, it was, and he took the boat out, it was quite an adventure. It was usually 3 months later before you could get back. And half the time there would be strikes and what have you. So she was gone for quite a while. So, and he had this dog called Bugsy. We thought he was a pretty neat dog. Anyway, one day my dad walked over. We knew he was a carpenter. He introduced himself. He said, "My name is," I said, "I'm Al Owen." He said, "How'd you like to go into business with me?" He said, "Ben Kraft doesn't want to be bothered with the lumber, and I can get this piece of land right down here where Sutloff now is located." And he said, "We could have a little carpenter shop, lumber yard." And he said, I got an agreement with Fred Solberg. Is it Fred Solberg? Oh, am I getting that confused? Anyway, the man that had the sawmill out there, and he said, "How'd you like to go into business?" And Norm said, "Gee, it sounds like a fine idea." I shook hands and they went into business. Owen and Sutloff.
Oh, wow.
And so then when my brothers came back from the war, we started to build a cabin out there. And I remember the snow was really deep and the island and lake was all froze over. And there was only a couple other cabins on there. There was the main part of the house that you see down there, there was the shingle mill and his little cabin.
There was the beaver dam and a trail around the lake. And across the lake, Wilton White had a cabin. And good grief, I didn't think I'd forget their name. They have a jewelry shop. A silk jewelry shop there in the mall.
That's silk.
No. Blankenberg.
Oh.
Mrs. Blankenberg had divorced that young man's dad. He's not related to her. But she had a daughter that was my sister's age, and she had a little gift shop. And so my mom and she were good friends, and mom would work for her off and on. Anyway, they had a cabin out there, and we used to go out and stay overnight out there. And that's what they call Dark Lake now. But that was all one lake. And the little peninsula out there that Breckens has now, the settlers had, and he and Daddy built a little cabin there. They started ours. We never got ours completed. Ours was down there about where Chase is at a place. Well, you wouldn't know who they are now, but they were at the other end of the lake. Anyway, I can remember trudging across there and sitting over there. And the snow was, for me, was quite deep.
Right.
And, you know, building when they got those built. But anyway, that's how Sutliff came to be, was because they had finished building the base. And Norm was just doing some carpentry work around town, and so he thought that was a fine idea. And
that's really neat.
Yeah. In the meantime, my dad got this. He'd sold his interest in the fishing boat, the Marmot, to Tom, and got the place out there with my brother Bob. And so that's how we got started with fisheries. End of it. And as a result, when the Fishery Institute was named after him.
After
my dad.
Really?
Mm-hmm. The last March. Yeah. Well, he was a legislator for 14 years and represented Alaska. I mean, at Kodiak and the Chain for many years. He also, at one time, it was part of Anchorage, too, and on out the Chain. But he was very much involved. In fact, the reason the state fishing game exists today is because my dad introduced the legislation.
You're kidding. Wow, that's amazing. I had no idea.
Wow. Yeah. He did many things. He said that I encountered the other day someone who knew him quite well and said, your dad did many things people will never know about that have benefited the state. But he was always a very low-key politician. His reason for being in politics was not the big eye or the power play.
Mm-hmm.
It was, what can I do that will help Alaska have a better quality of life, provide more jobs, and help it be able to stand on its own two feet? Oh, it was a banker. Yeah, I know who it was. At the wedding, a good friend of my brother's is a man that worked at the NBA for many, many years. And I had one of my first jobs from high school there, and I was John Erdman. And he said, they were sitting there in the car and said, and I said, well, I said, we're your friends, you know. And he said, well, don't you remember John Erdman? And I said, oh, yeah, you had brown hair, and you worked upstairs, and I was in the basement. And then he went on to manage a couple of branches. But anyway, he was involved with the NBA for a good many years. And he and his wife, but Fred had died in the fly. My brother's been an airline pilot since he was, since about 56. He now flies us Northwest. His son and his daughter-in-law, too.
Wow.
All Northwest pilots. And it was his youngest daughter. Not his youngest daughter. He has a 2.5 months old now. His youngest daughter, 23, got married. And now they have 2.5. This wife has raised Sunday, but this is her sister. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. We all seven of us had got together for the second time in 50 years.
Well, that's really neat.
Yeah, that was neat.
All right.
Yeah, we just came back from that and had a great time. So I don't know. I probably can't give you anything of that's really, worthy to put down that you find interesting. But
actually, I think it's all really interesting myself. Do you plan to stay here forever in Kodiak? You think you're going to stay?
Well, I would be.
Really?
Mom probably would like to live somewhere else. Having come from the interior, his idea of great living, I think, would be a ranchette somewhere, with a horse and whatever.
Sure.
But we just got through driving from. We went down, drove around in Oregon. His brother lives there, and he hadn't been down to see him and his family for about 15 years. So we thought we'd drive down there, and we stopped and visited some friends along the way, and we made the big circle. We went to Portland and then around and then come back to Pilot Rock. And all that, it was, you know, lovely farmland and lots of cattle. And I thought,
glad that I live where I live.
Every time I thought, you know, it was a drive on Monday, my sister, they just found a car down there, and they just got through driving it up the highway, and Dee Dee got in last night. She was so happy to be home and take her little baby with her.
Well, I guess my last question to have is, what's the biggest change you've seen in Kodiak? Are there just so many that you can?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think the biggest significant changes, nothing really changed until the tidal wave that I could see, because when I'd come back to visit, nothing had even been painted. I used to be, you know, it had been about 15 years. We left in 48 and went to Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
Daddy sold his interest to Norm because it, at that time, couldn't sustain two families very
mm-hmm.
well. And my dad was always on to other things. And he went over there as a business agent for the fishermen of Cook Inlet. So anyway, after I graduated from high school over there, and then I went to University of Alaska, and they had then moved back over to the fishing site, and he and Mom had put in little hand-packed crab cannery and fish. And then my sister and her ex-husband had joined them a couple years later. And built a little hand pack, and they bought a boat to fish crab with, but it sunk in a storm. But when they were getting all of their household supply over there to build a house, they managed to get it all off. There were folks in the area that could get it off, so they salvaged the building material. But that ended the crabbing that was in the early days of crabbing.
Yeah,
so she could tell you a lot of, you know, as far as in fact,
no.
I would think that she'd be a lot more interesting to interview. interview because she's fished out there for 30 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of kids from town fish with her. She likes to share her experience with others.
Yeah. Well. Actually, this has been really neat. How long has the movie theater been here for?
Well, that particular one was built. See, all that you see down there right now, everything but the museum, was replaced by Urban Renewal.
After the tidal wave?
After the tidal wave. Urban Renewal, they had already signed a contract with Urban Renewal to come in and redo Kodiak. Because it got redone in a different way. They took all the hills and flattened it down because you realize at that time the whole island sunk about 6 feet or so.
Oh, no, I hadn't realized that.
Yeah, and then it has come back up somewhere around maybe 2.5 feet to 3 feet. So it put it rebound a little bit. But they put in about 6 foot of hill down there to keep the tides from coming in. It would come clear into where this station is. And the old schoolhouse used to sit right up there where those apartments are. That's the only hill that's really sort of left. But they leveled all this, and there used to be quite a creek that ran. They called it Brooklyn Avenue. It was down here, Brooklyn Creek. Because they used to call it the Brooklyn Bridge. There used to be a lake right down here.
So,
when Mount Katmai blew, it filled it up.
Oh, okay.
That's where we got all of our ash
from.
That's
right.
And the houses that were down in this area were all built on silks that covered this area down there.
Oh, okay.
So all of this has been leveled and filled in. It is totally different. Like I said, after I came back after 15 years, I was amazed. Nothing had changed. I guess there was a little pavement on the main street. It was a crooked little street. That was about it. There wasn't a paint job. Nobody had done anything to any of the buildings.
And that was in?
That was in, let's see. 48 and 15.
No, okay,
57,
so
about
nothing has changed. Well,
had changed that I could see. I mean, they may have built the waterfront, you know, was all taken out during the tidal wave,
all
the docks and everything, and they brought that ship in to replace the Alaska Packers that was there.
Well.
One of the kids in town was sort of not right and was thinking of sort of a fire, but you said it on fire.
Oh, you're kidding.
And they have the gold Bible in there, and it didn't burn in that hot fire. It did not burn. I had a couple other icons.
Wow.
Because redwood burns very hot.
Yeah.
In fact, the oldest shed out there at Marmot was made out of redwood that was brought up.
Huh. When did that burn?
It burned to right after the war, had been somewhere about 1940, was it ending 42, 44, West Japan, or somewhere around, but it didn't get rebuilt until about 1947.
And then it survived the
tidal wave, yeah.
Tidal wave?
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Those tanks were there during the war, and we used to live in a little house that belonged to the church. That was another place we lived, right next to the church. Right next to those tanks. And Mom used to say we'd be prime targets.
Yeah.
We lived in that little house. Wherever you could find a nest, you'd